So, hey guys, welcome back. And we have another podcast. This is a return guest. We have Garner Polinsky. He's down in San Diego doing some great stuff. And he wrote a book called Wyatt Earp in San Diego. I urge you to go on Amazon or booksellers near you. If you're overseas in Europe and Australia and places, Amazon's probably the best place to go to buy the book. But if you want to buy the book with a personal touch, maybe some wording in there or to my friend or whatever, and a signature, I urge you to go to Garner, and that's G-A-R-N-E-R, Polinsky, P-A-L-E-N-S-K-E, GarnerPolinsky.LLC@gmail.com. Again, GarnerPolinsky.LLC@gmail.com. And that way he can get you a book with an autograph in there. He can write some words, whatever you want on a personal touch. That's the place to go. And he'll get that book shipped right to your door and he'll take care of you. I know he'll even kiss each book and say, go on my way. Go out and spread Wyatt Earp history in a factual form. But if you're overseas or in Australia, Europe, wherever, and that high shipping cost, you can go to Amazon and you can find it there. Of course, I want to thank my friends at the Wild West History Association, actually my second family at wildwesthistory.org. We have Roundup 2023 coming up in San Antonio, Texas. I urge you to join and become a member. They'll become a second family to you. It's how I've met all these wonderful people that you hear on the podcast is directly tied to the Wild West History Association. You can also find them on Facebook and YouTube. And Dave Guyton, my good friend Dave, is running the Instagram page. So you can find Wild West History Association on Instagram, Facebook. They're everywhere. There's no excuse that you can't become a member and be part of the Wild West History Association family. We also have a new partnership. It's not really a partnership, but it's just a good friend. He's a good guy, and that's Bob Bozbell. We're supporting True West Magazine. Now, if you want to find deep researched articles with beautiful pictures and maps and just so much, and articles, and there's a classified section in the back where if you want to get into dressing up and becoming more involved in the Old West, it's all there in True West Magazine. So go to truewestmagazine.com, just like it sounds, truewestmagazine.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, subscribe button, tap that subscribe button. And there's all sorts of options and things you can do to become a subscriber and get those issues delivered right to your door. This month, in the month, May 2023, well, then one of the newest ones was 216 historic saloons you must visit before they are gone. And I'll tell you what, I'm starting to chip away at those saloons, and I've been to a bunch of them already, and every one I go to, I take a selfie and I knock that one off my list. So again, go over to True West Magazine, become a subscriber at truewestmagazine.com, upper right-hand corner, subscribe, and get this magazine delivered right to your door. Now, the last time that Garner and I spoke was March 27, 2022. I told a true story about how I met Garner through a recommendation of John Bosnecker, a mutual friend. And John is like, listen, if Garner has written about it, about Wyatt in San Diego, it's 100% true. And we met, and we don't converse as much as I would like to because we're both so darn busy, but he's just a great guy, and you want to check out his book. And the podcast. That podcast is back in my archives. If you're kind of lost at what we're doing, go listen to that one first. Come back to this one, and you'll understand why we're at where we're at in the podcast. Now, the last time we spoke, you and I were talking about racehorses, about Jim Leach, and the fact that he didn't really have 12 horses, or some say he did. First, welcome. And let's talk about those racehorses.
Yes, good morning, Mike. Nice to be here. Why don't we start with a little background on Wyatt Earp's horse racing pre-San Diego? And there's some interesting stuff about that. Of course, the 12 racehorses is in this part of it, too. So what we know, certainly Wyatt Earp's a man of his times, and the horse culture was really strong in the West because you used your horse for probably everything, transportation, recreation, whatever. So people were very into their horses. So there was pretty vibrant horse racing going on across the West. So if we talk about, let's start with Tombstone just a little bit here. It's a interesting story, and it goes into research I did, which I presented at the Tombstone Territorial Rendezvous some years ago. So we have Tombstone, kind of the Tombstone period, Earp period, you might call 1879 to 1882. The Earps are there. Of course, we know how that ends with the gun battle. But Tombstone in 1879 is really expanding. Silver's been discovered there. So they want some more recreational opportunities for these hardworking miners and folks. So John Dooley in that time, 1879, he's a business guy, has a bar, harness-making shop in Tombstone. He decides Tombstone needs a horse racing track. So on March 1st, 1880, Dooley acquires the land on Contention Road for the track. The track becomes more than the Tombstone Driving Park. It's like a community center. They have baseball and all those things. What's really interesting about this, you can go to Google Maps or Google Earth and look at the desert in that area. It's kind of out by Shiflin Monument on Contention Road, and you can still see the outline of the horse race track. One of the TTR events, Tombstone Territorial Rendezvous events, we actually went out to the track and looked at it. So Google that sometime. It's really interesting that we can still see that. But anyways, the rumors were that Wyatt raced his horse many times in Tombstone and that he had 12 race horses. So I went through this. I researched through all the historic newspapers, all the other documents, and really have a different look at that. So to start with, in the 1880s, when they had the horse racing, they kind of only had horse racing over the holidays. So that would be, what, Christmas, New Year's, Easter, maybe Thanksgiving. So there wasn't an opportunity to have everyday horse races, usually, especially in Tombstone. So what I found from researching historic newspapers that really Virgil and Wyatt entered horses in horse races. The one I found specifically in the newspaper, Epitaph probably, 1880, that Virgil ran Old Doc was the name of the horse, and Wyatt ran Sorrel Reuben in that event. So that was the only event I could find where it was openly advertised that the Earps were racing horses. But it kind of makes sense because, as I just said, the horse races are usually in the holiday time, and honestly, the Earps living in Tombstone is really from December of 79 till March of 1882, so there weren't a lot of horse races for them to go to. So if you look at this, there's only one documented case of the Earps racing in Tombstone, but it's really plausible that the brothers raced in what they called in the day free-for-all races. So that might be Wyatt Earps in the Oriental talking to somebody and they start bragging about their horses, and then a race is going to take place, and it could take place in the street in front of the Oriental on Allen, or it could take place at the racetrack and there'd be heavy betting on it. So that's a likely some aspect to Wyatt Earp's horse racing. Probably the most important mentioned of Wyatt Earp with a horse racing horse would be the story about the horse they called Dick Naylor. So this is a famous and disputed story that I went deep into again to try to understand better. All the stories talk about the adventures of the racehorse named Dick Naylor. And the story that's most commonly told is really interesting. So on January 14th, 1881, Michael O'Rourke, and the name he's called is very famous, Johnny Behind the Deuce. He kills Pete Schneider, and he's the chief engineer of the Tombstone Mill and Mining Company, while they're gambling in Charleston together. So shortly after that, Charleston was a suburb of Tombstone, which had a really tough crowd. The Klans hang out there. A lot of cowboys hung out there. So as soon as this occurred, George McClevey, the constable there, realized a lynching could occur. So he grabbed the Deuce, put him on a wagon, and took off for Tombstone, which I think is about 15 miles away, to protect him. So as the story goes, the lynch mob is approaching the constable, and out of nowhere comes Virgil Earp riding on Wyatt's famous horse. Dick Naylor grabs the dude, puts him on the back of the horse, takes off, beats the bad guys to Tombstone, where there is a documented standoff between the bad guys and the Earps at Volgan's Bowling Alley. So, you know, I'm looking through all the newspapers trying to find mention of Dick Naylor, White Earp's famous horse, and I don't see it anywhere. So fundamentally what this, where you get to with this is that all the mention of Dick Naylor comes from authors that interviewed Wyatt Earp in his later life. And that includes Florestine Hooker, who wrote The Arizona Vendetta in 1919. Stuart Lake, of course, we all know, one of the fundamental authors, original authors of Wyatt Earp history, and described Dick Naylor as a powerful thoroughbred horse. Walter Noble Burns, same thing. But what you find out is that all those interviews, again, were done with Wyatt when he was older, 71 to 80. And that's the only mention coming from Wyatt as a source. So I think the answer here is Wyatt did have strong racehorses and stuff in Tombstone, only one that we know of. And Dick Naylor is a name that he introduced later in life. Maybe he didn't remember. He thought it was an appealing one. So there's probably no real Dick Naylor is the summary of that story. Now we move on to White's in Tombstone, of course. He ends up in San Diego in November of 86. So he's a big horse guy, and horse racing was starting to come to San Diego eventually, because White was doing so good with his illegal gambling operations. He bought a horse named Jim Leach, who he bought from an attorney. He ultimately has, what, four: Jim Leach, Dapsty, Ben Harrison, and Lottie Mills. So he races these horses throughout San Diego, and the opportunities are pretty frequent. For example, we had the San Diego County Fair in 1889 and 1890 was held in Escondido, not Del Mar as it's held today. I think Del Mar started in the 60s. So this was a fair where they had horse racing. He ran one race with his horse and then ran another race in the 1890 fair, and then actually was a judge for a race that he didn't compete in. What's really interesting, if you look at my book, you'll find a picture I have from the Escondido History Center that shows the exact race of the 1889 fair, and it shows the racetrack and all the crowd, and who knows, there's, you know, 500 people in the crowd, and you can tie that directly to the story of that race, which is White Earp's the referee. So take a look at that photo in my book and see if you can find Wyatt in there, because we clearly know he's in that arena at that point in time.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I know Escondido. The 15 cuts right through it.
Yep.
Where was it?
I researched that a lot. Do you know where the old Montgomery Wards is? Mm-hmm. Was, rather, in Escondido?
No, not really.
So if you went...
So is it on the east side or the west side of the 15?
It's on the east side of the 15, northern place. Escondido.
I got you. I know where you're at now.
So the book goes through a lot of stuff on that, too. That was really fun to research that. Nobody had really dug it up yet. I went to the exact spot where the track is. Of course, there's the old Montgomery Wards, which could have transitioned into another shopping center. So,
right.
Yeah. Hmm. So in addition to Escondido, we have the Hotel Dell coming online. That's in Coronado. It was the first hotel to have electricity in about 1886, 1887. The Earps were there watching the foundation being poured in 87, according to Josie's memoirs. During the winter months, they had racing there, and that seemed to be pretty clean racing in December. So White Earp was running horses there. I also found and collaborated a rumor that there was racing at Pacific Beach, which, as you know, is a San Diego community known for a younger person type vibe and all that. And initially, the Pacific Beach Driving Park had only training races that Wyatt went to, but I found one race that Wyatt, in 1890, ran his horse, one of those horses in. But about 1890, about the same time that the Dell was going, people were getting tired of all the cheating in the horse races. Commonly, the races had heavy betting, and there was cheating and, you know, confrontations with weapons and all that. So they formed the Pacific Coast Blood Horse Association in about 1890. So that was going to be a statewide series of horse racing and kind of making it more legitimate. The stops were going to be L.A., San Jose, most big cities in California, Oakland, Napa, Stockton, Coronado was the last race. So at that time, 1890, we had a change in the police chief in San Diego and also the mayor. So they were cracking down on illegal gambling. So for that reason, and because of the new horse series, the Earps relocated to San Francisco and lived there for quite some time. And that was more central to the state, so they could do all these. And for some time, I don't know how many years, 2 to 3 likely, they went on that series and lived a life of racing their horses and doing well. The Earps also got to know Lucky Baldwin, who's a famous guy in San Diego, not well thought of. And they raced, I believe, Jim Leach at the Chicago World's Fair about that same time, too.
Wow. Crazy to think that all that stuff was going on.
Man, White Earp was a true sporting man. I mean, everybody said that, but if you look at what he's doing, you know, everybody says White Earp's like the sheriff and did all this good stuff, but if you look at the bigger picture of White Earp, I think his goal was to become like a sporting man full-time, and that's what he did a lot of his time. The kind of the law enforcement I see is an avenue to make money to survive, because sheriffs made a lot of money in that period. They got a percentage of the taxes, but most of White Earp's activities tell you he wants to achieve a higher social status than that, which some say he did. You know, he's obviously an icon today, but that's really why he did the law enforcement, to get money for other events.
But I read, and then if I'm wrong, I know you're the first to tell me I'm wrong. Besides my wife, it's you, my wife, and Garner. I read in Wyatt Earp Anthology, which I consider the Bible of Wyatt Earp, that while this was going on, and I was reading about the horse racing in your book, that a lot of the money was being taken by Josie. Is that correct? Because she had a gambling habit?
I would agree with that completely. And I'd say that hypothesis is supported by most people. That's the case. So Wyatt made a lot of money. I mean, we can talk of a few times that he made a lot of money. The Harquahala, which he did in 1889, which was a mining strike. You can read about that. Mining strike in Arizona. He made a lot of money, and you can see that when he returned for that, he was there maybe a year with Josie, he immediately started buying a bunch of property. But really, most of the time, he struggled because Josie did have a gambling habit. I know reading, it's probably Anthology, I don't know which article it was, but I know it was mentioned that, I mean, they didn't have enough food in the house, that Josie would gamble the food away and maybe make a hot dog for Wyatt. I think there's some of the stories. So I think that's very true, Mike.
So Wyatt's doing this stuff, and you mentioned Hotel Del. We were talking in our first podcast about the cement being poured and that Wyatt Earp was most likely in the area while the hotel was being built. Is that right?
Yeah, we know that for sure because he's there in November of 86 and the foundation is poured after that.
Crazy. Where did the rumors then that he had all these horses, where did that start from? Was that in San Diego?
I think the biggest rumor, the 12 horse rumor, came from Tombstone. And that's, I don't know where I got that, what the source of that rumor was, but like a lot of things, you know, we debunk these stories, and usually the true story is even better, but that's the case. I work with a lot of people in that horse race analysis of Tombstone, Nancy Sosa, of course, one of the great Tombstone historians, and Ben Trawick, also to try to sort that out. But it could be he had more horses, but again, those could have been used for these kind of non-public events, but I couldn't find any documentation of more than that one that we had in that newspaper article.
And then for you, before we continue on, for those of you who are listening to the Doling Racetrack, you can also, if you plot it, it's on the road to Tombstone Mountain Ranch. And when you're on the road, it's a dirt road. You can drive on it with a car. You don't need four-wheel drive. You don't need a high high lifted vehicle or anything, or, you know, fancy truck. You can drive it with a car, and the road will split. You'll see a split where this road splits off to the left and goes to this massive power plant. And then the road goes to the right. Well, in that V is where Doling's racetrack was at. So after you plot it, and I urge you to like pull over, you know, watch for snakes because they're out in the summertime. And I've gotten out and explored it like you have, and there's tin cans and all sorts of debris out there. And you can actually see where the track is at, even in the bushes. So it's, if you want to be a part of it and touch that history that, you know, a lot of people want to touch that hasn't been, you know, commercialized or whatever, going out to the racetrack is insane.
Really great. That's great to see that. And you can see the berm caused by the horses running and kind of the dirt moves to the side. That's just fascinating to put your hands on that. I agree.
If you're wondering who this terrific guy is we're talking to, it's Garner Polinsky. He's got a book out called Wide Open San Diego. We did a podcast together back in March of 2022. So if you want to go back in the archives and listen to it, we really talk in depth about Wide Open San Diego and Horton Plaza, where Horton Plaza is today, the Stingery, all the things that were going on in San Diego during Wide Earp's period. Again, that's in the archives from March 27th, 2022. And if you want to get Garner's books, of course, you can go to Amazon and get it and delivered right to your door. But for me, and I actually do have an autographed copy, a very limited edition that he sold. Remember those ones from TTR?
Yep, I do.
Yeah, I've got a limited edition. It's only been touched once. It's in a box. I keep it in my bookcase and I stare at it. And I think it came with some CDs too, right?
Yeah, you know, those CDs have wider San Diego real estate information that I didn't digest yet. So if you're an aspiring researcher, have at it. It's right there for you.
That's great. So I don't think you have, do you have any more of those for sale?
I probably have 10 more. We did a run of, I think we did a run of 86 because Wyatt Earp came to San Diego in 86. I think I'm down to 10. So those go pretty quick, actually.
You've got to get that. If you're a Wyatt Earp fan and a collector and you want some insane and book like that from Garner, please go to garnerpolinsky.llc@gmail.com. Again, that's Garner Polinsky, PALENSKE.LLC@gmail.com. GarnerPolinsky.LLC@gmail.com. And you're going to want to get that limited edition. He's got 10 left. He brought it to a TTR and I snapped it up. Like I couldn't even get it into the truck fast enough. And he did autograph it and left me a real nice note. And I just feel honored to have it in my Wyatt Earp collection. As Wyatt Earp continued progressing in horse racing and stuff, he realized at some point, like you said, he wanted to be into the sporting crowd, and boxing had always been there in his life. Even in the early years, we talked a little bit about Kevin Costner's movie Wyatt Earp and a man named John, where do I have
Shaughnessy.
It? John Shaughnessy. Shaughnessy or Shaughnessy?
Shaughnessy.
Right. And so talk a little bit about John, Honest John.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. And that's really how we know, how we follow Wyatt Earp, his story about being in prize fighting and what he did. So that story is a famous, again, story told. It's shown in Kevin Costner's movie, Wyatt Earp. And that's the Wyatt Earp gets asked to be a referee of this fight. John Shaughnessy is one of the participants. Donovan is the other one. Shaughnessy is getting murdered in the fight, doing bad. And Wyatt Earp stops it. And then Shaughnessy becomes a friend of Wyatt Earp based on that movie. That part is true, that he was friends with John Shaughnessy. Shaughnessy did a lot of things. He actually, in later years, was in Yuma, Arizona, which Wyatt went to Yuma. And they collaborated there. He had a bar. John Shaughnessy had a bar in Yuma. The story about that fight's interesting. So I dug really deep into this for another TTR presentation I did. to try to see what the truth is about the prize fight with Donovan and Shaughnessy. So what we know is in Cheyenne, Wyoming, where it took place was July 4th, 1868 or 69, it did occur. A fight did occur with those two people. It was at the Cheyenne Depot. 3,000 people attended. There's good sources on that. Was Wyatt Earp the referee is the question. Stuart Lake would tell you that's the case. And as the story goes, Wyatt stopped the fight, saved Shaughnessy. No source on that I could see, but the newspaper did talk about there was a TKO. So we probably have half of our information on that, and then pretty much speculative information for Stuart Lake that all this happened, which is probably the source of all those stories. We do know Wyatt Earp participated in prize fighting quite a bit as a referee and somebody that went and was a spectator. You know, Wyatt Earp was certainly good defending himself, and certainly that's a physically defending himself. That's a trait he had to have to survive being a policeman in Dodge City, because really the policemen in that day and similar to this day sometimes have to use brute force to subdue people versus shooting them, obviously. And Wyatt Earp, I think, learned that skill, and it prepared him for his time as a police officer, especially in Dodge City. I looked at kind of going back to Wyatt Earp as a referee and what was going on in Tombstone. At Dooley's Park, there were quite a bit of prize fight events that I could tell. I think there was one in April of 83 and May of 1885. The one in 85 was interesting because George Parsons, who was a very famous person in Tombstone, Parsons was a miner, but he wrote his diary that we all use, historic diary. He actually fought a fight against John Clum, and John Clum is the editor of the Tombstone Epitaph, you know, an intellectual kind of guy. I don't know the story behind that, but the newspaper Epitaph, I believe, had the George Parsons versus John Clum fight. Clum got knocked down, and then being these are two non-fighters trying to fight, the event was stopped. But really with the prize fighting, I think San Diego is central to the prize fighting operations of Wyatt Earp. So we know in San Diego we had a rough part of the area, which was at the border. So in these times, we're talking 86, 89, you had Tijuana, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. And there was prize fighting there. It was not a regulated area. And there were all kinds of prize fights along the border. These were bare-knuckle fights. And in an event we're going to talk about in a minute, the Sharkey Fitzsimmons fight, post-fight there was a legal hearing, and Wyatt Earp was called and testified. And he claimed that he refereed 15 to 20 bare-knuckle fights. These are illegal fights in San Diego at that time. So we have, say, 20 bare-knuckle fights, and then there were 1, 2, 3 legitimate fights in the city of San Diego where the people, the participants, wore gloves that he participated in. I don't think he refereed such a variety and number of fights any other time in his life other than that San Diego period.
But something that was interesting, I want to go back to John, Honest John Shaughnessy. Uh-huh. Is that not only did he go to Yuma and open saloons, but he became the mayor of Yuma. And was that around the time, and I could be wrong, around the time that Wyatt was coming in out of Yuma to Sentinel and going up to Harquahala?
Yeah, I think Yuma was later for Shaughnessy.
Was it way later?
Yeah, and when you go to Harquahala, let's see, so Harquahala, he probably went more north than he went east to get gotcha. Going. So I'm not sure he went through Yuma to get there. I don't remember where the train station was that he took going there.
I read some stuff about the town of Cibola. Yep. That was also during that period.
That was a little later.
Was
when Wyatt Earp, as you know, was
involved. See, I got corrected. See, I told you guys, when I'm wrong, Garner will be like, that's not right. But the bad thing is when you read all this stuff gets in your head, and it's just... you know, how they moved around that part of Arizona. But John did become the mayor. And then John ends up in Los Angeles. Is this true? He ends up in Los Angeles at 1917 trying to get treated for gangrene and dies.
I heard that was true, yes.
That's crazy.
Those guys moved around, and when you think about it, they used horses and primitive trains. It's remarkable how they traveled around the country. It was hard.
Yeah. They were just always on the move. When I was reading Anthology, I was surprised at how much Wyatt was on the move. You know, he was a constable in Cibola, then he was over in Sentinel. Sentinel was a train stop. You know, we talked about it in your first podcast in your book, where that was a discharge point, the exit point to go, which is a long ways from Sentinel to Harquahala. Hollow. And then Pete Spence was in Sentinel. You know, he's got some horrible things going on there. Like the players of Tombstone and then San Diego, it's just crazy. And then the people in San Diego were into Tombstone. Tombstone fails, they go back to San Diego. Just your book explains so much of what happens. That's why it's such an important read.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. That came out in the research. And really, Tombstone and San Diego are not that far apart. So when one boomed or busted, kind of a lot of folks came east or west, depending on where they could make the money.
So he's back to this fighting thing. Because not only is he in this fight, but then let's talk about where a fight that was really important to Western history and to Wyatt Earp, which is the Sharkey Fitzsimmons fight around 1896.
Yeah, so this is an important one because it kind of presented Wyatt Earp to the populace as somebody doing bad things and got him a lot of bad publicity. And it's highly disputed. So the fight took place. So Wyatt Earp is in San Francisco. He probably hasn't refereed a fighting event since he was in San Diego, say in 1888-ish. So he's in San Francisco, and this fight is organized on December 2nd, 1896. Earp was going to referee the Tom Sailor Sharkey versus Robert Ruby Fitzsimmons. And this was a world heavyweight championship event. It was at Mechanics Arena in San Francisco, a big event. So this turned out to be like the worst publicity Wyatt Earp ever got for anything, at least to this point. Probably worse than what he got from the OK Corral gun battle, or as we would call it, the Fremont Street gunfight. So basically this fight, Wyatt Earp is going to be the referee. He's not very prepared for this event. So he comes into the ring. He's wearing a handgun in his waist belt. So the police notice that right away. So in front of the whole crowd, he's disarmed. And later he's accused of fixing the fight when he calls a foul against Fitzsimmons for a low punch and awards the fight to Sharkey. So there's big litigation about this. Ultimately, you know, there's a purse of $10,000 after testimony from everybody, including Wyatt Earp. The judge, I think it was Judge Austin A. Sanderson, ruled the fight was technically illegal and therefore out of his jurisdiction and didn't recognize the injunction that was filed. So why don't we talk about the details of the fight? There's some new information on that. And we're going to approach this as, is the fight fixed? Or is the fight fair? Fixed means fixed for the outcome. This is from an article I wrote in True West Magazine. You can find, if you go online and Google the fix, you'll see this article that comes out with this new information that gives kind of a new aspect to this. So we know, again, the allegation is that Wyatt Earp is the referee. He sees a low blow from Fitzsimmons, gives the fight to Sharkey. And I found some new information, and Casey Tiefenkiller, who's one of the best Wyatt Earp historians of all time, provided this.
He's stunningly good looking, if you have.
He's a cool guy, too. He's helpful and nice. So anyways, there's involvement. So Casey turned me on to an article that was written by Charles Fennell, and it was in the 1951 edition of the Chicago Posse, a Westerner's brand book, obscure publication. So in this article, it's called Wyatt Earp in Alaska. So apparently, Fernales claiming that he was on a ship traveling to Alaska with Wyatt Earp. So he claims that Wyatt told him that iodine had been injected into Sharkey's groin, which is where the low blow was aimed, to simulate an injury. So really what that does with the iodine, I studied this a little, clearly it magnifies bruising, but also it can cause nausea and other symptoms that would be similar to what would happen if you were injured in that way. So it's a smart way to fake a punch to that region, if you will. And Earp is talking about this, and he said he didn't know about the iodine trick until sometime later. And this is pretty consistent with the opinion the doctor for the fight talked about, that the his statement was that the post-fight injury was not consistent with what the alleged injury was. So we can see in the department of It's a Fix that we have this new information that hasn't been talked about much that indicates it could be possible that this occurred. Also, it was openly known that Sharkey and Wyatt Earp were friends, which made him being an impartial referee as difficult. Now, under the department of this was a fair fight, you know, it's difficult. When I thought about this and researched it some more, it's pretty difficult to see the fight if you're in a big arena very carefully. They didn't have the big screen up on the, you know, marquee so you could see it. So the only person that really could tell if there was a low blow was probably the referee, because he was standing right there. Also, under the fight was fair department, why would they wait to the eighth round? That didn't make much sense. It does make some sense that it could have been fair, because Wyatt Earp, again, hadn't refereed for a while, and between the time he had refereed and this point, we had transitioned to a more friendly type of boxing match, if you will. There's no more bare knuckles. There's more rules. They're trying to make it legitimate. So Wyatt could have been out of practice from refereeing. That would be, you know, logical. And the new rules were tighter, and he overreacted at the low blow. But either way you look at it, I don't know we can say which one occurred. To me, the fix looks more obvious, but that can be debated. We know that it was claimed by Wyatt's wife, common law wife Josie, in her memoirs, which is the Caisson manuscript that you can read, that Wyatt felt betrayed and that the sporting crowd had thrown him under the bus and he was going to get the heck out of that line of work. Well, that really isn't true, because new information again. Less than a year after Sharkey Fitzsimmons, you see Wyatt Earp hanging out with Sharkey at another event, and that was the Corbett versus Fitzsimmons fight that was in Carson City, 1897. And also, it's announced that that Wyatt Earp is going to start helping Sharkey as an advisor and a manager, and also would be principal in the ring should there be another fight. So then we get to probably the biggest new discovery on the Sharkey-Fitzsimmons fight that gives some relevance to it, that again you'll see in that article in True West called The Fix that I wrote. Sharkey gets a fight with Wyatt Earp, and it would be Sharkey against Peter Irish Giant Mayer. And again, this is a tune-up fight, because both fighters, Mayer and Sharkey, want to get back as contenders for the world's heavyweight title. Wyatt Earp was announced as being not only his manager, but also, again, would be in the ring with Sharkey. So later that month, April 1897, Earp and Sharkey head back on the train to New York, get there early before the flight to do some training. They stopped in Yuma, where Wyatt probably went and saw Shaughnessy, because Shaughnessy was there, their friends. And still public sentiment against Wyatt Earp was strong. I think, let's see, what do they make? They talked to him about, of course, the San Francisco Call magazine, which was an anti-Earpite newspaper, certainly said, called him a remarkable referee in all-around sport, jokingly. And then when he left Yuma, the Yuma Oasis newspaper called him an all-around tough citizen, and Arizona was well rid of him. So Wyatt Earp's public appeal at this time was not good. So they get to the arena. It was the New York Plaza Athletic Club. The fight's going on. This is really interesting event. It's June 9th, 1897, sold out crowd, 7,500 people, and the purse was about $12,000. So what was interesting about this fight, this is in New York City. New York City decided to try to legitimize their fights in a stronger faction. So they tried to take all the violence out of these fights, which it's a prize fight, right? How do you do that? But they had a new law called the Horton Law, which basically turned these into sparring matches where you scored points, kind of like you do in a real event, but they discouraged the aggressive punching, kind of a ludicrous idea. So the police were ready to enforce it at the fight. They told everybody at the first sign of brutality, the fight stopped and people will be arrested. So we have this getting ready to go. The New York police commissioner was there. He was really into fights and watching this. He was in a front row seat. The name of the commissioner was then a little known man by the name of Theodore Roosevelt, who went on to be our 26th president. And we know Roosevelt certainly was a fan of boxing, so this all makes sense. The bad news to that storyline is that it was well known that the police were very corrupt, exactly focusing on fixing of fights or payoffs. So I'm not alleging President Roosevelt was involved in that, but quite an interesting connection, of course. So the fight goes on. So Sharkey and Mayer get in there. First, they're smiling at each other, trying to toe the line on the Horton protocol. They can't do that. Somebody hits somebody, and then it gets crazy, and they're really fighting. So the police stop the fight, arrest everybody involved. Everybody in the ring gets arrested. So that includes the fighters, the referee, managers, everybody. They arrest them and take them to jail. So about an hour later, everybody posts bail, $500. They're released. And still, there's the scandal of what was happening with this. I think the paper described it as a very unsatisfactory contest. But the striking news you should remember from this piece is that Wyatt wasn't in Sharkey's corner during the fight, as the newspaper said he was going to. Prior to the fight, Wyatt sensed the contest was going to be anything but fair and reflected on Sharkey Fitzsimmons probably and beat it back to San Francisco. He arrived in San Francisco June 4th, 5 days before the fight. And here's the punchline you want to remember. So upon arrival, he told the Los Angeles Times, quoting regarding the fight and quoting the Times article, that the fight had been arranged for Sharkey to win on the same principle as Sharkey's fight with Fitzsimmons. So what does that mean? So years later, according to this article, the LA Times, they're saying that Wyatt Earp is admitting the Sharkey-Fitzsimmons fight was fixed. So Wyatt Earp was the referee who called the low blow and stopped the Sharkey-Fitzsimmons fight. So in essence, he's claiming the fight was fixed and he was the main actor in the disqualification of the fighter. So I think this is some pretty interesting information. After this fight, Wyatt clearly didn't do other fighting that we know of, maybe local stuff as far as being a referee, and that pretty much ended Wyatt Earp's time as a referee.
It's so crazy, Garner. Crazy all the stuff that's going on that you've dug up. Of course, if you want his book, go to garnerpolinsky.llc@gmail.com for a personalized autographed copy. Or you can go on Amazon and get that one if you're overseas in Europe. You want to keep the shipping costs down. That's another way to go to Amazon. Now, we got about 10 minutes, 9 minutes, 10 minutes left. I got some questions for you.
Okay.
First off, this is going to be a weird one if you haven't listened to my podcast.
Okay.
If you could get in a time machine, go back to any period, and I'm going to say in Wyatt Earp's life, because you've been mostly researching Wyatt Earp, along with some other things we're going to talk about. But in Wyatt Earp's life, or any period in the American West, where would you go and why?
That's kind of an easy question, and I've thought about that one too. So I would be most interested is in going back to Tombstone, starting when the Wyatt Earps arrived. So let's say that's December 79. or when the Earps arrived, sorry, in 79, and just see what they do and see how they reacted with people. Did they really do all the things people said? How did the hostilities with the cowboys start? And just understand all the background. I think the gunfight's been overreported. I'd certainly want to stay for that. But so the answer is probably going to be from November or December of 1879 and probably through the Vendetta years. So that's probably 1872 or 1882. So if you did that, you'd have a good understanding of why the fight started, which is paramount to understanding it, and just how the Earps interact with the cowboy faction. So I've thought about that question myself many times, so it's a pretty easy answer on my part.
Because I think it would be cool to stand back and to be on the sidewalk when, you know, over at the Gird Block, when the fight happened, when the incident on Fremont Street happened, and see it from a perspective view of standing back. You know what I mean? I think that would be, you know, if I was to go back and somebody said in the Tombstone years, where would you, because I have lots of places I'd like to go, and go see that from a standing on the sidewalk.
Yeah, I think we'd understand it because, I mean, we're pretty visual people now. We have all this visual stuff. You know, you can read about it in a book, and many of the books that describe the gun battle, you can picture it, but there's nothing like being there. So I would agree. Who knows what we would see? I mean, you could see the body language of the Earps. You could see how it played out, and we would understand things much better if we could do that, Mike. I agree.
I've talked to many writers and historians over the last, you know, 62, year 63 podcasts that we've interviewed. And a lot of them will say over time, as they begin to write, a certain name will pop up or an incident will pop up, and they'll either create an Excel spreadsheet and drop that information. Let's say, God, this name keeps popping up all the time. It keeps popping up. And they'll go back and they'll say, gosh, I've got enough content. I think I can actually go back and write a new book. Are you working on something because of your research with Wyatt Earp in San Diego? Do you have anything new coming out?
Yeah, there's a near-term thing I'm working on, which is not, it covers the same period as Wyatt Earp in San Diego, and that's a book that I'm commissioned to do right now. The manuscript's due in June, and I've been working really hard, and that's about Thomas Whaley. So Thomas Whaley is the person that built the famous Whaley House in Old Town. It's considered America's most haunted house or whatever. So Whaley's a guy that is born in New York. He's a young man when the gold rush hits in 1848-ish and comes to California, comes to San Francisco. He's a rich guy, highly educated, just a young man, and lives the dream of living in through the gold rush period. Eventually settles in San Diego and goes through just so many events. You know, the things that people don't realize about the gold rush is, except maybe John Bosnicker, who would know this quite well, is how wild San Francisco was. I mean, really wild, with gangs burning buildings down and all that. So I had to research that and I learned about it. There's all types of stuff. There'll be the California Indian Wars, which were not like the Apache Wars, but they were still significant. And then just the lawlessness and development of San Diego. So that's a everyday project now that soon I'll be able to talk about when that's coming out. So that's on the table. That was kind of given to me through a mutual interest. But I'd say the kind of the big one that I got from the Wyatt Earp work would be the Harquahala stuff, and certainly that the name comes up of Carmelita Campbell. So that's a stunning story about a woman who was a Hispanic woman miner that lived in this era of male dominance, and she was a partner of Wyatt Earp's at the Harquahala. So that, I've done a lot of research on it. It's really hard because it's a time where we don't have very good records, but that's the one that was on my spreadsheet. I do spreadsheets too. Like I do chronology on spreadsheets and everything else, and I kept seeing Carmelita talking to Don Chapik about it. So that's one certainly that's going to happen. Hopefully there's enough for a book. It's just a marvelous story, and I hope to do that one certainly.
Well, quit screwing around. I mean, honestly, you're messing around with all the stuff. I can't wait for these new books to come out. You got to get them done. I'm pushy.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun. You know, it's a lot of work. The Thomas Whaley one, which, you know, I'm doing and now I'm really into, it started slow because I didn't know this period of history, mm-hmm. but now it's spectacular. There's just not enough time. Probably every author you talk to says he has all this cool stuff and there's just not enough time. And kind of you need a lot of time to do these projects because it's so much fun and the level of your understanding is so much better that you just dig to the depths of everything and you come up with what you think is the story and then you understand it for a lifetime and present it to people.
I think you're right. I mean, when I talk to the researchers, historians, writers, and all that, some of them will say that they have the best time researching and digging. Some of them will do everything off the internet. Some of them like to go down to you talked about in the first one, going to the Huntington Library, like how much fun it was to actually read the newspapers, hold them in your hand and read through their stories that, you know, you end up having so much like, oh my God, I wanted to write about that person and I want to write about this thing and I want to write about that place. And there's just not enough time to do it. But, you know, when the book does come out, and I've talked to some of them, when the book does come out, it's like all this work is done and, whew, okay, can't kick back my laurels. I got to get off on this one and get this one done. My gut tells me you're the same way.
Yeah, you know, the research is the fun part. It's really hard work. I can think about on the wider book where I dug up certain stuff and I couldn't sleep all night about it. The most fun time I had, I would say, would be at University of Arizona doing Arizona research for White Earp that involved my book and the Huntington. I mean, the Huntington, they have these old archives of books. You go down in there, it's all dusty and stuff, and there you see every Western book you ever saw. You can hardly read. It's all dark and stuff. So, I mean, if my wife didn't go with me, I'd still be there starving to death probably, still in the library researching. It's just magic. It's just so fun.
Well, I'm ready to go and you are. Like, if you're like, hey, dude, I'm going to want to go to the Huntington, I'm there. We'll book it. We'll go. We'll get it done.
It's really cool. I mean, I enjoyed the time at Special Collections at University of Arizona. I had those trips mm-hmm. down, you know, from San Diego.
Right.
I could fly there at that time in an hour. I could be researching at 11, go to lunch and stay till they closed. It was one of the highlights in my professional life doing that. And that's not over yet. There's other Arizona stuff to work on.
Well, you guys heard it. You heard it here first. Nowhere else would you get this. He's got a new book coming out. I can't wait to read it. And we'll get him back on the podcast again. Of course, we're talking to Garner Polinsky. You can find his book, White Earp in San Diego, on Amazon. For those of you who live in Europe, and shipping is real expensive. And if you want an autographed copy, something a little bit more personal, go to garnerpolinsky.llc@gmail.com and get that. Of course, I want to thank everybody. I got so many people to thank because all of these people that I'm thanking are how I get here to interview the best researchers and historians alive today that are putting out the books and the content that we love. And we got some great people coming up in June that if we can get the date settled, you're going to love these. Of course, I want to thank my friends at the Wild West History Association. Become a member at wildwesthistory.org. I want to thank my friends over at True West Magazine. If you want deep research, beautiful photos, artwork, and a little bit of Bob Bowes Bell, you can do that by going to truewestmagazine.com. And the reason I mentioned Bob Bowes Bell is Bob is also very instrumental in my quest to interview people because many, many times I get to a roadblock and I'll reach out to Bob and I'll say, Bob, can you help me? And I'll tell you what, within a day or two, sometimes that day, he'll get me the phone number, the email, he'll connect, and you will hear some of these people coming up in future podcasts, and you've heard some of them already because of my connection and relationship with Bob, and that's through True West Magazine at truewestmagazine.com. Go to the upper right-hand corner, click on the subscribe. There'll be thing in there with a whole list, a menu, basically, of all the different subscriptions and what you can get to get True West Magazine delivered right to your door. Also, my friends over at the Tombstone Epitaph. I almost got back to the Wild West History Association. You can find them over True West Magazine. I'm all messed up. Let's do this again. My friend, it's what happens. I'm looking at everybody here. I want to thank everybody. My friends at the Tombstone Epitaph, Mark and Eric are working hard to bring you Arizona's longest running newspaper, and that's at tombstoneepitaph.com. It gets delivered right to your door. It's about 20 pages. It's an actual newspaper, which I love, so I can take it with me to the airport when I'm traveling, and you're going to want to read it, and then you're going to want to share it. Like, don't take it, and if you have somebody that wants to understand more, share it with them or keep it for your archives so that when you need researched information, you can be like, oh, it was over at the Epitaph. And you can be a subscriber at tombstoneepitaph.com. You got anything else, boss? Anything else?
I think I'm good. Thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. Appreciate you guys. Safe travels to everybody, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.